people used to get like nutrient deficiencies that are now completely solved just because the food system has been, in many ways it's worse, but in some ways it's better. People aren't getting goiters because they have a deficiency of iodine. Like, it's just, that doesn't happen. You don't need to like monitor that. But on the other hand, more subtle things that haven't been solved and there is no solution, that's where you have to monitor and tweak and do all these things, right? So it's really at the gray area where we have solutions, but they're not perfect. That's where you have benefits for monitoring. If there's no solution, knowing that something's going wrong doesn't really help you. But if there is a solution, but it's kind of subtle, like there's no one size fits all solution, for example, that's where monitoring is like really beneficial.
I'm Ben Grenell, part of the early startup team here at Levels. We're building tech that helps people to understand their metabolic health. And along the way, we have conversations with thought leaders about research-backed information so you can take your health into your own hands. This is a whole new level. Glucose is not a panacea. It's something that Josh Clementi, co-founder of Levels, often says as well. Well, he sat down with Michael Dubrovsky, co-founder of Syfox Health. Syfox Health is another health tech company in the space. They recently went through YC or Y Combinator in the summer of 20. And Syfox offers an at-home product where people can measure 17 different biomarkers at a much lower cost than competitors. And so we know glucose is a very important molecule when it comes to measuring and monitoring metabolic health, but in isolation, it is only one molecule. Our bodies are in constant orchestration, oscillation, with all these biomarkers doing different things at different times. Some move in parallel, some move in sequence. Others have very inverse patterns in the way that they move, which might be good, or maybe it's something that people want to look into and learn more about why the implications of that might not be so good. And so Michael and Josh sat down and discussed this idea of why we want to monitor all these different biomarkers. What's the point of biosensing? Which molecules should we be monitoring? What are the implications of diet, sleep, exercise, stress, environmental factors, all these things that can make biomarkers move in constant fluctuation in our bodies? Bodies are extremely complex, and they're very much this closed system that we have very little insight about in this day and age. It seems absurd, but we've got more insight about complex systems like airplanes and rockets than we do with the data that is in fluctuation in our own bodies. Anyway, no need to wait. Here's Josh and Michael.
I really want to first introduce the problem, which is one that I care a lot about. I know you care a lot about it as well. And the question is, like, what is so important about biosensing is the first part of it. And the second one is, you know, what should we be measuring and why is the additional element of multiple molecules of monitoring so interesting? This is going to like lead us into a question of how we get to a future technology. But first, I think the question is, like, why should we be measuring things about the human body? And does it matter if you can measure more than one thing, for example?
That's a big question. So originally, it's maybe worth going back and like originally, why did people start doing this? I mean, I think it's probably pretty recent that people seriously decided that it's useful to start measuring things in blood. I'm actually not sure what the first thing was. Maybe blood typing for like blood transfusions, things like that. I mean, they used to look at like how long it takes your cells to, I think they actually still do this, the erythrocyte sedimentation rate. It's like how, if you take the blood out of the patient, how long does it take for it to settle out? And that's kind of proportionate to your inflammation a little bit. So they used to do these types of things. So ideally, you wouldn't really have to pay attention to your body at all. I think that would be, that would probably be the ideal case, right? I mean, there are some people that are doing it for entertainment, and I'm one of those people. Like, I like to do it for entertainment, but I think for most people, they probably don't want to pay attention to it at all. But it's being operated like very far outside of its design specs, right? So you're taking this ape that's supposed to sleep in a cave and wake up with, you know, probably wake up at sunrise and like walk around all day. And then fall asleep exhausted or something like that. You're taking this ape and like sitting them down at a chair and indoors and having them do whatever, digital marketing for 12 hours a day. Right? So I saw this really funny. I don't remember exactly what the quote was, but it's, you know, it's like this person listed all of the things they were doing to improve their sleep. And they're like, yeah, and I finally I'm sleeping like I would if I was sleeping on a rock, you know, and waking up
cold, damp
like,
rock.
Yeah, on a rock, on a damp rock, like naked, you know, like that kind of thing. So I think because we're, first of all, because we're operating completely out of the range that the bodies are designed for, but also because we're trying to get much more out of them maybe than what you would typically get. So maybe we're all trying to get like the ideal outcome, not the average outcome. It starts to make sense to make measurements.
Why does it make sense to make measurements? I think that's something that, you know, it may actually be a leap for some people to know. What is it about measuring specifically what's inside the body that gives us any additional information that might be useful?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the typical approach is more symptomatic. So I think like medicine historically is symptomatic. So if you don't feel, if nothing feels wrong, then everything's fine. But as we've started collecting, let's say over the last 100 years, started collecting much more information about biomarkers in general, including blood biomarkers, but other ones as well, we've found that it's, you can see things in the data long before they manifest themselves as symptoms. And also you can start, things are labile and you can see this, right? So you can see kind of incredible things happening. So like, obviously it might not be a good idea, but you can take hormones and become enormous, right? So like people are putting on whatever, 50 pounds of muscle by taking basically a tiny catalyst that completely changes their body. So obviously the circulating markers, it's not just bulk things like weight gain, but it's also these small things that are present in very small quantities that can catalyze like enormous changes in your body. And being able to monitor that can, first of all, allow you to know what's going on and know how your body's responding to what's happening, but also allow you to make changes that you want, right, effectively.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice summary of the principle, which is that, you know, we're playing with these levers that are manipulating these molecules circulating in our bodies every day, hundreds of times, right? We're making all these decisions about what to eat, how to sleep, you know, we're exercising, we're eating, we're working, and the goal is to like achieve some outcome. And meanwhile, we're kind of ignoring the complexity of the human body, which is we're like flicking all these switches, but we aren't actually measuring the state of our bodies, which, you know, as far as we can tell, is the most complex system in the universe. So I think there's something there, which is that by simply assuming that we can control our health over long time periods, but not measuring our current state or how it's changing, we're like really missing the forest for the trees, in my opinion, around what it means to be healthy and what optimal might look like. And I think your point about like we're outside of our comfort zone as a species is absolutely right. You know, our environment has transformed 100x over the last 100 years. And yet, honestly, like many of our sort of health monitoring strategies have not. So like, I think most people's health strategy is wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and figure out if something's totally wrong. And you know, yeah, we're kind of using like eyes and ears to see if we're really going off the rails. So we can kind of improve, we can take the same complex system, you know, sensing that we have in our cars and in our airplanes and in our diagnostic machinery and apply them to the body, I think is maybe where we're heading.
Yeah, I think that's like the, so I would say that that's the one side of the argument. So if you take the devil's advocate side, right, like things that work, you don't really need to measure. So for example, like if you take like a building, you know, parts of the building that never, you know, just never fail, don't really get tested. So it's really where, you know, you put sensors where you expect to have problems. So like wind turbine, you're putting a sensor, you know, on the motor because that fails and catches fire. There's like all these epic videos of wind turbines spinning on fire, right? So it's, I think for certain things, like ideally anything that can be solved completely. So for example, people used to get like nutrient deficiencies that are now completely solved just because the food system has been, I mean, in many ways it's worse, but in some ways it's better, right? And so there are nobody, like people aren't getting goiters because they have a deficiency of iodine. Like it's just, that doesn't happen. So you don't need to like monitor that. But on the other hand, more subtle things that haven't been solved and there is no solution, that's where you have to monitor and tweak and do all these things, right? So it's really at the kind of like the gray area where we have solutions, but they're not perfect. That's where you have benefits for monitoring. If there's no solution, knowing that something's going wrong doesn't really help you. But if there is a solution, but it's kind of subtle, like there's no one size fits all solution, for example, that's where monitoring is like really beneficial. That's actually like most of medicine because it's mostly not that effective. Like that's the problem. There are certain things that are super effective, you know, like if you break your leg, they can put it back together basically. But there's many, many things, especially long-term things that are effective, kind of like if you look at the studies, you know, it works for 50% of the people or whatever, things like that. And that's where monitoring can really help you see and tweak and actually get the, you know, get the 50% result that's actually good rather than being in the 50% that, you know, got no value out of something.
Yeah, I think even in cases where there isn't a solution necessarily, I think we have to kind of reframe our opinion around whether it's worth knowing that. Because, you know, there's a situation where somebody doesn't necessarily have a cure for a condition. For example, you know, there are a number of hormonal deficiencies where the body just does not produce certain hormones. Like there isn't necessarily a cure, but there are solutions that can manage those conditions or see the onset of them and make better preparations, you know, I think, and sort of set life up to be more, to be capable of a better quality of life. Should you understand what's going on. And so I think, that's another element of this, which is that there's a large number of individual cases that we're kind of talking about in generalities here. But what I think it comes down to is just the reason that we would want to measure what's going on in the body is so that we can understand the health state and how it's changing over time. And it's that like setting a sort of baseline and understanding it in relatively high resolution. And then how the, like you said, the areas that are likely to fail, looking at markers there and watching how those progress is a really powerful tool to know kind of maintenance interval and or potential failure modes. For some of us, like the cardiovascular system might be the first to go, and we can start to see the indicators of that relatively early. And this is one area that current medical system actually looks at. Whereas for cognitive decline, we don't really have markers of how that system starts to degrade. And we use things like basically cognitive function as opposed to the biochemical signature of what underlies that to know what's happening. So, you know, I think that it's generally an argument for increasing the amount of information but not just like overall volume. Data is not data in this case, actually looking in the areas where we know failure is possible and that we're playing with the levers already, maybe with our decisions. So that was I wanted to lead into the next part of the question, which was, okay, measuring makes sense, but what about like the frequency and the, you know, how do you choose what to measure? And also how do you choose the frequency? You know, what today, I think most people who would be listening to this care a bit more about this maybe than the average person out there. But let's just say in general, in the US, most people maybe get blood work once a year, maybe once every other year, get a panel of results and you sort of get a PDF with some numbers printed on it. That is a frequency that you can measure. So, you know, you get blood drawn and then you get a piece of paper once every 2 years, let's say. Why should one measure more frequently than that? And what additional information does it unlock to do so? Like, what's the consideration around frequency?
So I think it's useful actually to give some context. So I myself, before starting this company, maybe hadn't had a blood test in like 5 years, maybe 6 years or something. So, and even like after we realized we would be building, you know, at the beginning, we weren't sure we'd be building a blood testing device. So it's after we realized that we'd be building it and we got past the first kind of technical hurdle, so we knew that it could work, you know, it can be built. I started thinking like, what can even be the biggest impact of something like this? Because typically, you know, okay, let's make it a little bit easier to do the same blood test that's normally done. Let's do that once a year. So this is actually an interesting point. So if you ask 100 doctors, like, what do you want from a blood testing tool? They'll say, I want to do the yearly blood test while the person's in my office so that mm-hmm. I can just get the data and discuss it with them while they're there, because people just do that blood test, they disappear or whatever, right? So that's considered like the burning issue in healthcare in terms of blood testing. But when I started doing my own research and looking like, is this really the biggest impact we can make? Like cutting off, you know, going from two visits to one visit or whatever, right? And I kind of found that what's actually happening, first of all, the yearly blood tests for many markers, because they fluctuate frequently, if you're getting them once a year, you're really looking at, you don't know if you're looking at the noise from the fluctuation, like depending on what happened to you that week or what time of day it is that you ended up coming in for the blood draw, that type of thing. Or are you looking at a real change? So usually doctors, what they do is they look at, unless you have somebody that's, you know, a functional medicine doctor, or you're paying for like very high end longevity care or something, they're just looking, are you way out of range? Like, have you gone completely off the normal human range? And do we need to start basically doing a bunch of tests on you to figure out what's going on? Or do you need to completely change your life because this is like really high risk, right? And that the reason they're operating that way is because the blood test frequency is so, that's one of the reasons, is that the frequency is so low that if they were responding to small changes, they might just be responding to the normal variation. Like there's variations even related to the seasons. Like you're going to have variations based on season. You're going to have variations based on, like if you take a testosterone or cortisol test, that the peak is like 1 hour after you wake up. And so if you show up, I mean, if you, there's that, it's like half hour here, half hour there, could make a 10% difference. So you're basically going to, like, they can't respond to that because they can't even time your blood test perfectly. So for all of these reasons, what they're doing is just taking a very blunt approach, which is, okay, you're within this general range, which is like the 95%, like two standard deviation interval for the population. Whatever, maybe the population is very unhealthy, but like at least you're within that like two standard deviations, and come back when it will check you again and like we'll see what happens. So this, I mean, I'm not the first person to say this. This is a common complaint that like they just wait for you to become very unhealthy before doing anything. But the question is also like, which tests does this matter for? And I think for many of the tests that they do yearly, you don't really expect to see changes. So like blood counts and other things, not all of them, it actually makes sense to test more than once a year. But the reason that the complete metabolic panel, which is what happens every year, the history of that test, as far as I understand it, is it really started with what they could test. So you can take the person's blood, put it under on a microscope slide and count the cells. Like people used to do this visually. There were technicians that would look into a microscope and just count your cells and write them down on a piece of paper. So that's like the type of blood test they could do. They could measure very high concentration stuff. So like they used to, a good example is CRP. So CRP is a C-reactive protein, an inflammation marker. It goes up when you have a bacterial infection, but normally it's supposed to be very low. And until recently, all they had was the CRP test, which was actually, they could only measure it at very high levels. And then about 10, 20 years ago, they started being, you know, a higher sensitivity test came out. It's called hsCRP. It's really the same marker, but at a lower range. And that's when they started seeing that, okay, actually, you know, people are chronically elevated on this marker for no reason. So they don't have a bacterial infection, but this marker is chronically elevated. It's not as high as it would be if they were super sick, but it's much higher than it's supposed to be in a healthy person. And so even to this day, they don't really address that part of the range, but it's marker to marker dependent, like which ones it really makes sense to measure frequently or even continuously. But a lot of the ones in the yearly panel actually are relatively stable. And that might be why they've kind of like evolutionarily ended up there.
We should contrast the annual sort of stable markers. You raised good points about like most of the molecules that are circulating in our bodies have like they're a kind of a combination of a half-life, meaning they're that, you know, the molecule is actually like changing over time and being replaced. The actual molecule is degrading and being replaced. You've got circadian rhythm. So you've got like sort of day and night cycle. If people are, let's say people work second shift, they might have two circadian rhythms that are like overlapped. So there can be this dysfunctional double circadian mm-hmm. rhythm thing and other variations on it. And then you've got the impact of decisions. So, you know, my cortisol spike may be naturally circadian driven with the peak at 1 hour after I wake up. But if I happen to do CrossFit 45 minutes after I wake up, maybe my unnatural cortisol peak ends up being an hour and 30 minutes after I wake up, meaning I have stacked two peaks on top of each other with like this unnatural elevation. And so anyway, the point being where if I want to understand how cortisol levels impact my quality of life, my mental health, my, you know, my sleep, that sort of marker that is fluctuating on a inside of a 24-hour basis, we know and have and are able to measure this. That's the type of thing which, yes, we measure it on our annual panel occasionally. But what I think many of our listeners would be interested in is what do we unlock by kind of measuring those more labile markers on a more continuous basis that we don't get otherwise. And one thing I specifically want to talk about is like load conditions. You know, like the body is it's a machine, it's a dynamic machine. We're moving around, we're making all these decisions, we're putting it under stress. And as such, like the annual panel is designed to be taken in the lowest load condition. It's like you fasted, you've slept well, right after you wake up, go in, no coffee, no nothing, get your blood work. In many cases, that's by far the best case scenario. You know, so why do we test that way? And what would a continuous or like maybe not continuous, but higher frequency detection unlock for us?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, more broadly, I would make the claim that if we're going to make progress on the 120-year lifespan in general, or whatever the health span is now, like 80 years or something like that at best, we have to start figuring out what's really going on. So for example, if a drug is going to get us to, or a set of drugs or whatever procedures is going to get us to like 150-year lifespan, for sure that's not going to happen without measuring the effects of that drug. Because any longevity drug, you won't see any symptomatic effects for decades, right? Mm-hmm. So if you need to start taking a drug at 30 to, you know, to live to 150, you won't see the effects of that for several decades. So it has to be in the biomarkers. I don't think there's anywhere around it. That's kind of one of the conclusions I came to doing my research for like what's the biggest impact you can have with biomarker, like being able to measure biomarkers more cheaply and conveniently, right? Mm. But I think to answer your question more directly, I think for most people, it's probably the end use, like they have like an end goal, right? So they want to sleep better, or they want to lose weight, or whatever. It's like typical health goals. They want to prevent like diseases XYZ. I mean, 6 out of 10 Americans have a chronic disease at this point. So it's basically, if you don't have one now, there's a good chance you'll have one in the next 20 years, let's say. So just trying to avoid that or optimize something locally, like sports performance or something. There are 3,000 proteins in blood, and then there are also a bunch of metabolites. I don't know what the total number is. Maybe you have this number in your head. It might be like 11,000 molecules or something that are circulating.
It's tens of thousands, yeah.
Yeah. If you start counting metabolites, it goes really high. But I think it's also, the good news is that it's also overdetermined. So a lot of them are parts of chains. So basically one induces the other. So if you're measuring one, so like I'll just use CRP again because I mentioned it. So CRP is the inflammation protein, but it's actually induced by what are called cytokines, which are like these signaling molecules that will tell your body that it needs to have higher inflammation. And so just to give an example, like if you get poison ivy, what's really happening is the oil from poison ivy is binding to proteins in your skin, which your body starts to recognize as like foreign proteins because they change shape from the binding of the oil. And then your T cells, which are like an immune system cell, releases cytokines into your blood or into your interstitial fluid locally, and it just explodes basically. So like a bunch of inflammation is triggered this way. But anyway, so if you're measuring CRP, what you're actually measuring is the cytokine levels one day ago. So you're mm-hmm. dynamically, like you're like a day delayed, but you're actually measuring the other molecules from a day ago. So in a way, you don't need to measure all 3,000 to get the data. In many cases, the systems are overdetermined. And you can get a lot also just from looking at time series data. So you can look at one marker over time, and it tells you something about what's going on in the more complicated systems. So I think that's the good news in terms of like there's this huge you know, zoo of things in your body, but actually they're very connected and we've learned a lot about them. So taking all that information, you can actually zero in on like a couple of markers and get a lot out of that.
And that's a great callback to towards the beginning when we started talking, which was, you know, why would you measure more than one thing? And the answer is right there, where you can start to take a few properly selected molecules and use them to interpret and act as proxies for a kind of a whole network of things. So I think you explained that well, which is that you don't have to measure everything in the body to know kind of what's going on. You can find the high leverage elements like CRP, which can then be used to interpret, T cell activity and cytokine activity. And there are these specific molecules. Hormones are a really good example, which are really information dense. You know, if mm-hmm. you zoom in on hormones, you know, they are basically like the messenger molecules to the distributed network of our cells. And if you can interpret that signal, what a specific hormone's concentrations are, you can kind of approximate what is going on in a complex system. And then you can even measure a byproduct of the cells to see, like, did they follow the instruction set? And that can tell you whether you have kind of a central nervous system issue where you're not sending the right signals to produce the right hormones, or do you have a cellular issue where the cells are just not responding to the hormone signal? And that's a really powerful, like, high amount of data or high quality amount of data that is interpreted from a few results. So I think what I'd like to go dig into a little bit more from there is essentially, like, how do we decide what to measure today? You know, why do we have the panels that we have? And if we can measure this stuff now, why are we not just measuring it in higher quantities already? You know, are we measuring the right things? And then if so, like, why don't we just go get more blood work? What's holding back a huge industry here?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the big progress in blood testing happened probably in the late 90s and maybe early 2000s. So, you know, I mean, if you talk to somebody who's older, like who was working in blood testing 30 years ago, it's not a precise science, right? So one of the issues is that people are very heterogeneous. So if you take 1,000 people and you test them all on the same test, it's actually a massive battle to have that test give the same result, if, you know, like, actually a correct result. And the reason is that people are very heterogeneous. They have all kinds of, I mean, again, 11,000 things in the blood. They have all kinds of things can be going on. And so the industry has gotten a lot better at dealing with that. So there's been all these waves of things that people have figured out. The FDA then pushes down a, like, decree, okay, we have to be dealing with this now. And then, you know, that improves all the tests. But even to this day, for the best instruments, they don't really perfectly agree with each other. So it's nothing like, if you come from, like, electrical engineering or whatever, where somebody sells you a product, it says 5 volts, and you measure it with a voltmeter, it says 5 volts, right? That doesn't exist. But within some error, that's starting to be the case, especially for the more well-established targets.
When somebody goes to get a lab panel and let's mm-hmm. say they measure their total cholesterol, what should they expect that the realistic accuracy?
We've done a ton of testing on this ourselves because we're in the business, right? And the older, my feeling, this is my intuition, I don't have, like, perfect proof of this, but the longer a test has been on the market, so for example, total cholesterol has been on the market for whatever, I actually don't know how long, but certainly decades. And the longer it's been on the market, the lower the coefficient of variability. So, you know, if you send in your sample 10 times, you're going to have a 5%, you know, difference. But if you take a vitamin D test or you take a testosterone test or whatever, those tests have really not been offered for that long and at that high volume. And so you have to definitely take those with more of a grain of salt in terms of, like, if you have a change of 5%, like, you shouldn't see that as a real change. Especially if you're making, like, one, two measurements and you just see that they're essentially equivalent. That's my personal belief. This is not based on a big study or anything like that.
I think people would find that kind of counterintuitive. They would think, okay, newer tests are going to be made with better technology. Like, this is going to be much higher quality. And so, what do you attribute that error?
What is it attributed? That's very interesting. So it depends on, so I didn't really finish the story of what happened is people have done an amazing job of automating and scaling up relatively complex assays in what are called, like, clinical analyzers. So it's these basically giant robots that take in tubes of blood, pull out fixed volumes, and they all run even all the competitors have almost the same thing. So they're all running the same types of assays. There's three types. It's blood counts, chemistry, and immunoassays. So chemistry assays are more like you just mix a bunch of things up and shine a light through it and look at the change, typically in just the absorbance or scattering and things like that. And you get, there's a chemical reaction going on inside that you're monitoring. Immunoassays actually require proteins that recognize the target. And that starts to create all types of differences. So for example, that protein that recognizes the target, Roche, which sells an analyzer, they validated their assay for vitamin D against their previous model. So they were basically, they sent the FDA a document that said, our Roche analyzer, you know, 1000 works exactly like the Roche analyzer 900, but they never validated against the Abbott. So if you send your sample into two labs and one is using the Abbott, the other one's using the Roche, like apparently I've been told that doctors that are like sophisticated doctors will send your sample always to the same lab. Because otherwise, if they're serious, like they want to know the differences, they want it to be tested always on the same instrument. And it's these types of things, like these subtleties that aren't completely harmonized, especially it takes years and years to find the differences because they're, again, people are heterogeneous. So it might only happen in like 1% of the population that there's a small difference between these two machines. And these are the types of things that get ferreted out over the course of like a decade.
Just process improvement and technology improvement. Yeah. So I think you've sort of introduced the concept of the actual underlying equipment. There's this whole industry and machinery behind the simple process of going into the doctor's office, getting blood pulled. That stuff vanishes somewhere. We don't really know where it goes. And then a week or so later, you get a phone call and you have a PDF in your hand. You know, you had mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that doctors want to be able to provide results in real time to the, mm-hmm. or at least in the same visit. Explain for people why there is currently such a long lag. Like, what's going on there? Why yeah. is a blood tube being sent across the country to get a result, and what's actually happening to it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, I should preface this with saying I'm by no means an industry veteran. You know, I haven't been doing this for. It's very fun to talk to the blood testing industry veterans. They're all very, it's kind of, they're like sailors or something. They're all very, I don't know. It's like, it's actually like a pretty down to earth industry, I would say, because I mean, in general, in biotech, therapeutics are really what make money because you can sell the same drug to a billion people. It's like software, you know, it's incredibly mm-hmm. profitable. Diagnostics and instruments in general are considered, they're like pretty low status because it's all like the margins are super thin and you have to, you know, the equipment's just difficult. But anyway, so I think it's important to note that it's a pretty down to earth industry and they're definitely doing their best. So the history of the industry is basically that people realized that they wanted to have the whole test done in the doctor's office. Like everybody knew that. It's kind of obvious. It's like saying, you know, I want my iPhone to run ChatGPT locally, you know, like it was obvious to everybody. And there was like a vacuum for somebody just to say that they could do it. And so that's what Theranos did. They were like, all right, we're just going to say we're doing this, right? That was like the minimum viable product is just to say you're doing it. Of course, like nobody in the industry eventually like believed them because they couldn't show anything, but that was enough to like, you know, do five or 10 years or whatever of, I guess like 5 or 7 years of fundraising and everything. That killed a lot of other companies that were working on real solutions, but some of them survived. And again, I got into this only in like early 2020. So I wasn't around for the whole fallout of that. But of course, like it killed a lot of companies, you know, because investors got very scared of the space and everything. That's one of the reasons, really, that we don't have these things. The other reason is that doctors, if they need a single result that you can't produce on your device, they're going to send a tube of blood to the central lab. Because at the central lab, they have three different tools: the blood count, the chemistry, and the immunoassay that do all the blood tests they want. So basically, they're just sending the tubes there. They don't care. They just want the results. They don't care what machine it's run on. So people have struggled to build a machine that will do everything they want so that they don't have to send a tube. Because as soon as they want one result that is not possible, that's it. But there are a few companies like Truvian, Genolite is doing this. There's also Vital Bio. There are a few companies that are trying to package up the complete blood panel and put it into the doctor's office. My opinion, I mean, this might be like a hot take or something. My opinion is that it's taking so long to deliver this that you might as well just go to the next thing. Like I think by the time that they deliver this, it's going to make money. Like I'm sure they'll make, whoever cracks this is going to make a lot of money, but I don't think it's going to have as big of an impact as people were hoping because medicine is just changing. Like, so this whole doctor's visit thing, the yearly blood test, like all of that is becoming, it's kind of starting to look stale. So that's the situation. It's really delayed partially because of Theranos, partially because it's a poorly funded low status industry in general. I would say those are probably the two reasons. It's not technical fully.
So I want to dig into two things you brought up there. Firstly, just for background context, like Theranos, of course, is the company that claimed that they could do an entire litany of tests with a single drop of blood right there in a microwave sized box. What they were trying to replicate and what this whole industry you just described is trying to replicate is the central laboratory industry. So those three giant analyzers in a room that takes blood tubes and can break them down and get the whole menu of tests that a doctor's interested in, trying to replicate that in the office. And so what you're saying, which I think is really interesting, is that you might as well go to the next thing because it's taking so long to replicate that entire central laboratory process in a small box that can be, you know, put in a doctor's office, that things have evolved. And I want to talk about two specific elements of that. Like the first is, how are things evolving? What is the next thing? And secondly, like, it's pretty crazy that a single example like Theranos can have as much of an effect as you indicated that it has. And maybe like first, let's talk about that. You know, why? What did go wrong there? And what lessons are we going to have to take from the Theranos story, you know, when we're talking about, for example, you know, what you're working on next?
I don't really know what went wrong. And what's interesting is that once you spend some time in the industry, you know, lots of people worked at Theranos. I mean, you start meeting people that work there. And the engineers that I've talked to, like I've interviewed people who work there at relatively senior positions, like scientists and stuff. I don't know. So basically, it seems that they were doing some kind of work in a silo that was going fine, you know? So basically, many people were doing work that was going fine, but there was some kind of like integration problem. I think this is something my co-founder says, but I think it's a really good point, is that like every hard tech industry has a Theranos, but Theranos got very famous because they gave incorrect results to actual people. You know, if they had never delivered anything, probably they wouldn't be very famous, but they were actually giving like, you know, critical results to people that were wrong. And, you know, they did all these things, but if they had just raised $1 billion, spent it and disappeared, that would have been, you know, there are LiDAR companies that did that. There are like, you can give a bunch of
examples. Just another Juicero.
The Juicero. Yeah. Like where, you know, the Juicero founder is not like being covered in the New York Times every year. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's any deep tech product, you know, it's just so difficult for investors to diligence. But I think in general, what they did wrong fundamentally is just trying to chase like the obvious problem that people want, you know, the like impossible thing that everybody wants versus being realistic and saying, okay, it takes three enormous instruments today to do this. What can be done with the technology we have or like can develop in 5 years, like while people are still paying attention, like, you know, you collect a good team, they have 5 years of like runway where they're really focused, you know, what can be done in that time? And I think that that's really what, when people do deliver is when they do that. There's a good example of a company that does a one drop at home test. It's like Athelis. So they also went through YC and they're FDA cleared now on the market with a blood count. So like for cancer patients and some other use cases, like you really need to keep track of blood counts. And so they have an FDA cleared device that does that at home. So this has been unbundled, right? Basically, instead of doing the whole thing without it, you know, having no idea how to do it, it's people looking focused like, okay, we're going to solve this piece of it for a particular niche where it actually works.
So what is that next thing that that you were hinting at that the industry should start to shift its focus towards?
I mean, I think this is going to happen in different parts, but fundamentally, so my family's from the Soviet Union where healthcare was socialized and kind of, I don't know how to put it, like both my grandparents were doctors, so I'm pretty familiar. Like my grandmother ran a pediatric hospital. I'm pretty familiar with the system. It's interesting that you can spend a third or whatever it is of American GDP on healthcare and get what you get. I mean, what we get is like really bad, right? For that amount of money. Considering what the Soviet Union was able to achieve, and like many other countries today are able to achieve with like very, very small, really like not that much resources. So I think if you look at it from that perspective, the chances of fixing the existing system, I mean, I might be like rambling here, but I think the chances of doing something super fundamental to fix the existing system are very low. But there are all these other kind of like things happening that are trying to circumvent it or just improve little parts of it. And I think that's working out great. So basically just telemedicine, all kinds of, you know, gray area services that are like wellness bleeding into healthcare. I think all of those things seem to be working. People are actually getting results from them. They're really low cost because they're self-paid. So there's all this, I think there's a lot of progress there, and that can all eventually move into being used by the healthcare industry. And it eventually does, like, so they adopt things that work. So actually it benefits the main healthcare industry over time anyway. It's just hard to start for it to start there. But I guess to answer your question directly, what do I think is the next thing? I think the big thing is, like, we don't really know how to cure chronic diseases. So if we did know how to cure them, it would be a moot point, but we don't know how to cure them. So probably prevention is the most interesting thing, because of the difficulty of curing and managing chronic disease. Like, management is interesting also, because probably we can do much better at managing them. But I think prevention is like where a lot of the value is. And that's also where there's a lot of room for innovation, because it just hasn't been touched.
Specific to the next sort of on the detection element, like, rather than trying to solve the central lab, what's the next thing there?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, focusing on doing the complete metabolic panel, that's like a strategic error, in my opinion, if you're starting a company today. Again, because that panel is designed for that yearly visit. And the yearly visit in and of itself is not that valuable, right? It's just not high value. Like, nothing happens at that visit, right? At the doctor, I mean, I went to a visit recently just to try it out, because I usually don't do the yearly visit. I didn't even see a doctor. I mean, I saw a nurse. She never talked to me. Basically, like, she gave me a form that asked me if I was depressed. And then she was like, all right, I'll see you next year. You know, it's basically, maybe there's a lot of innovation that can be done around that yearly visit, but then that innovation would also change what the blood test looks like, or what they're doing. I mean, they should probably be reviewing a year's worth of blood data that's taken weekly or monthly, right? Rather than looking at that point measurement. So just, it all needs to be reimagined. So if you're building something that takes 5 or 10 years to build to a spec that's like not working anyway, right? Financially, you could make money from it, but it's not going to change people's lives that much. So that anyway, but I think what's next, I think just looking at actually solving problems. So people have problems that are directly labile, right? Like let's actually look at what can be done about that, rather than asking just like, how do we slightly improve the cost of doing something that's already being done? Question is, what can be enabled? So I think those, it broadly falls into the categories of like issues with hormones, issues with like metabolic health, like weight loss weight loss, I think, is like the symptom, or weight gain is the symptom, but then whatever is going on, like the metabolic dysfunction, there's all the inflammatory diseases, and then cardiovascular, which kind of sits at the nexus of inflammatory and metabolic, right? So I think if you look at those buckets, that's where most of the value is like trying to help people manage those things, improve them, prevent disease, and so on. And most of that, in terms of technology, actually requires, or not requires, but it benefits enormously from just giving the power to the person to do the test. So like, if they can test themselves and have the context around that data, have like some kind of support, probably that support doesn't even need to come from a person. Maybe it doesn't. In some cases, maybe it doesn't. But just having the ground truth data already makes so much difference in figuring out like where the person's at, how they can make an improvement, like is whatever they're trying to do actually working for them? Like all these questions, none of that is answered at a yearly visit, you know, with the complete metabolic panel. So that's my take.
To unpack that a little bit more, there are all these circumstances people find themselves in day to day that they're trying to manage. And today they do not have the abilities, sort of like wait till the yearly checkup to get a test or a litany of tests, some of which may be adjacent to the problem you're trying to solve today. You know, it's like, if my problem is I want to lose weight, or if my problem is I want to have a baby, let's say, and I go to the doctor and I get my cholesterol panel and I get CBC and all these other things, and I'm told you're healthy, but I'm still having trouble conceiving. Those two things, the overlap is not what I need it to be. And so I think where you're going with this is like, we need to expand what we're detecting and the rationale for it. The traditional blood tests were developed for a specific reason, and they have some information value, but there are all these other like real world examples that understanding the the health state and the underlying kind of molecules that are driving it can be really powerful. But I think what you're describing there is like, if you were to give the person the technology that they could measure this themselves and more frequently so they can see changes, and specifically, I would imagine changes due to an intervention, which, you know, in the fertility case, maybe that's managing PCOS through different diet, which is, you know, PCOS is polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's very closely related to insulin resistance. And perhaps it's trying different dietary approaches to see if, for example, insulin relative to glucose starts to adjust. Can you give some more examples of these sorts of real world levers that you could build through testing to give people this kind of healthcare 3.0 world where you're not just focusing on symptoms and you're not just doing an annual blood test?
Yeah, I think for many of the things people care about, there are probably, you can find a menu of like 5 or 10 things to try typically. So, you know, if your sleep is very dysregulated, right, there are all these tools that, so you can go as far as like going to like a concierge service that will completely analyze your sleep and do all this. And as simple as like taking magnesium before you go to sleep, right, which is whatever, $5 a week. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason you would do a measurement, so you can just try these things, right? And you can even look at like sleep scores or whatever. But the reason you would do a measurement is to really see if there's a hormonal or metabolic reason why you're getting bad sleep. And that kind of ground truth information can be a lot more valuable than like symptomatic things. So even like the amount of hours you sleep, that's a symptom, right? Of something, of like an underlying process. So I mean, for me personally, like doing, like I've been doing a ton of blood tests because we sell blood tests and test blood tests and so on. I can actually like very clearly in my own data, just see when I screw up my circadian rhythm or other things of that flavor. You can see the connection between circadian rhythm and inflammation, circadian rhythm and like testosterone and things like that. So that's not true for everybody. So when we actually do correlations across a lot of blood tests, let's say inflammation is connected to sleep for 50% of people. So for the other 50%, it's actually not connected. So you can improve your sleep, but your inflammation will not drop. And so the cause is just something else. And every engineer that's like built anything has had to do 100 rounds of debugging. And so if you're not able to measure anything, you're not able to debug what's going on, it's just very unlikely that, you know, you're going to try one of these 10 things and it's going to fix it. And what happens is when that happens, people become like evangelists of that solution. Like all you have to do is fix your sleep. And that, you know, but it just like these things are so complicated and interconnected that that's not actually true.
Yeah. It's that anecdotal, but also, you know, trended data that you're pointing to there is really interesting. I think it opens a bunch of questions about how we can even start to tackle a problem like that, where you have interpersonal variability when you're trying to prove, for example, when you're trying to develop a new technology or test that has to show good results over, you know, a very wide swath of the general population. And yet you have these interpersonal variations happening. You know, that some of that goes to the intervention, meaning like sleep doesn't necessarily change inflammation for everyone. But I do think that it points to the challenge of getting a new technology to market when there isn't necessarily an intervention associated with it. Like we're not tracking a symptom. You're actually measuring for the measurement's sake. You're measuring to describe the person's health state better. The system really isn't set up for that. You know, the regulatory bodies don't think about measuring the, you know, all the molecular milieu inside the body just because you want to understand it and see how sleep affects inflammation. So how do you make the case that this should be measured and then produce compelling evidence that it's worth measuring, for example, inflammation or you know, the underlying sleep molecules or cortisol or something, when you aren't actually doing so to prove the effectiveness of an intervention?
That's a good question. So I think historically, the way people have gotten things approved for these kind of like home use cases or even wearables and things like that is they never really achieve the same performance as the central lab instrument. But what they do is they kind of make the argument like, look, you know, people need pregnancy tests at home. Like it just doesn't, they're not going to come in for this test. They just need it at home. And for some things, like that argument is very easy. And over time they get approved. But for many markers, that's not the case. And I think the best strategy, at least the strategy that we're taking, is just to develop things that are the same quality as the central lab instrument. And if you can hit the same quality as a central lab instrument, regulatory is actually not as hard. So I think it's the difficulty with the regulations has really been that home testing, because it's typically like paper strip based, has not really been able to hit the same level of quality as central labs. And because of that, it would really have to get like all the, you know, essentially have to get exceptions from the FDA. Like, okay, this isn't very accurate, but we're going to put it out because there's a great medical need, right? Or like a public health need. But how do you make that argument for sleep? Like, you know, they might not care about sleep at all. Like, right. What does it matter to, you know, like in their framework, like you're saying, that's like something that's way upstream of anything that they care about.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'd love to kind of do an entire conversation just about the regulatory framework and proof of necessity, proof of value. You know, that the next generation that you describe is where the person is in the driver's seat, so to speak. Like, we've sort of shifted the locus of control about what we're measuring and how we're measuring and when to the individual whose health is at stake. And they're measuring things that relate to their quality of life and their health span and the avoidance of, you know, conditions they don't want or quality of life they don't want. And that is a value statement to that individual. It's not a public health, like at scale, general population sort of health mission, which is what the healthcare system is currently thinking about. They're thinking about how do we, you know, lower the rates of stroke acutely, mm-hmm. and not how do we, that now that may be connected. And if you look at the daylight savings examples, you know, every single year when the clocks shift backwards and you lose an hour of sleep, heart attacks and strokes go up like clockwork.
That's really interesting.
And the opposite happens when we shift back in the other direction and you gain an hour of sleep. And so I think that what we're trying to do is sort of extricate ourselves from a situation where we are only thinking at the scale of everyone and shift to a condition where we're thinking about, you know, where I can only think about me and you can only think about you. And we're each kind of looking at many data points about ourselves and how we're changing and kind of adjusting our lifestyle levers along the way. So there's a lot there. I think the whole system is not currently structurally set up for the kind of proof of value that I as a consumer want when it comes to the healthcare or really the diagnostics that we're talking about.
So it's interesting. So we generally like are in heated agreement about this, right? But I think I just like to play devil's advocate where it's possible. I think like today, you don't really have a choice. Like if you want to optimize your sleep or whatever, there's no meta object that's optimizing your sleep. Like nobody is on a national level trying to figure out how to get people to sleep better. How do we figure out like what's happening, you know, this type of thing. That's not going on really. I mean, it is in some small way, but people are tracking it, right? But it's not like aggressively being managed. If you want to fix your sleep, like you have to do it yourself, make the measurements, just get the trial, the hacks, whatever. But I do think that there might be like an optimistic world where at some point there's enough data on enough people that you can actually start, like you don't need to do all of these experiments on yourself. So basically at some point you should be able to pool data from millions of people and actually start getting real insights that are forward compatible. So, you know, you bring in the millionth and one person, you make a measurement on them and you just tell them like, look, this is going to work for you. And that's already true in some cases, right? Like they're trying to do this for cancer therapy, like where it really matters, the medical system is pretty good. So they'll sequence your cancer, tell you like this immunotherapy is not going to work on you, that type of stuff. So I think there is an optimistic case for over time, this transitioning from, you know, like you're on your own, like you have to fix this, to it being much more solved and something where you can leverage the experience of millions of other people. But for that to happen, you have to, like, this all has to be built up. But I do think there's like an optimistic world where that happens.
Yeah. I would argue that that's not even a devil's advocate condition for this situation. It's a both and, right? Where I can, you know, both focus on my own selfish concerns and simultaneously my data could be aggregated and pooled into our sort of general population understanding of how inflammation and cortisol are connected or how fertility is affected by insulin resistance. And then we can like start to understand and potentially phenotype people based on a few very selective tests and quickly understand what intervention is most likely to work. And today we just don't use data in that way, at least not at a, you know, there are obviously exceptions but at least not in a wellness context where I'm trying to optimize my diet for for weight loss, for example, we generally do not understand what levers to pull for me versus for you. And that can certainly change. I want to kind of wrap, but mostly focus on the last few minutes here on what you're building. So, you know, this isn't just a conversation in the abstract. Like, you at SciFox with your co-founder Dietrich are working on a technology. I'll let you introduce the tech and kind of what you guys are most focused on right now and the major challenges. But yeah, tell us about what you're doing.
Sure. So the main thing that we're doing is we're miniaturizing one of these. So there's the kind of three pillars of blood testing that I talked about, which is the blood counts, the chemistry tests, which are like your lipids, your ions, and then immunoassays, which is proteins and hormones. So we're really focused on proteins and hormones. What we're doing is we're taking all the optics that go into one of these instruments, and it's mostly an optics instrument. So it's a lot of like lasers and lenses and things like that inside. And we've already done it. So we miniaturized all the optics onto silicon chips. So there's a whole industry out there that most people are not aware of, which is taking the technology that makes chips in your phone. So the electronic chips that drive phones or computers, et cetera, taking that technology and manufacturing optical systems with it. So miniaturizing optics. And that's been used mostly for the internet communication. So like this call we're having is being converted to light when it goes to a data center. And that light goes through fiber, and that has to be converted back into electricity for, you know, to talk to other electronics and computers. And that's being done by chips with miniaturized optics on them.
And just to clarify for people, like, the electronics is the electricity, but then the optics is it's the light. It's moving mm-hmm. photons instead of electrons.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So it's moving ahead. Units of light that goes through fibers. That's how communication is done between. And the reason for that is that light is very fast and like travels very quickly and doesn't interact much. So you can put a little bit of light into a glass tube that's, you know, spans the ocean, and it actually doesn't make it all the way to the other end. You have to amplify it as you go. But basically, it can travel a very long way without diminishing. And you can also pack a lot of data into it. But anyway, so that industry has been built up, and it's enabled the miniaturization of other optical systems. So we're leveraging that. Especially my co-founder, Dietrich, has a ton of experience in it. So he's actually, he was part of the team that commercialized the most successful optical chip for data center communication. So there are millions of them out there. They're like transmitting maybe 50% of internet traffic or something like that. But we're leveraging that technology, and we used it to miniaturize all the optics in the blood analyzer. And so what that's allowed us to do is cut the cost by a factor of, let's say, 1,000, 100 to 1,000. And cut the size by a factor of 100 to 1,000. So it's something that you can have, you know, like Alexa speaker size device that you've seen it, that you can have, you know, on your kitchen counter or wherever, that will give you 5 or 10 results out of a very small sample of blood. And what we're focused on is really things that it makes sense to measure at home. So like proteins and hormones that change relatively frequently that are associated with either health goals people have or chronic disease management, chronic disease prevention, things like that. So that might be like a panel of all the female hormones, like for IVF, or it could be a cardiometabolic panel that covers, you know, what's going on with your insulin, your inflammation, your lipids, things like that. So those kinds of panels that actually cover an area of interest for people.
That's really exciting. And for people who are getting jazzed up about this, like, what's the kind of time frame where you feel like you'll have something? And also describe a little bit more about the user experience. Like, what is this thing envisioned to be used in place of a continuous wearable? Is this something that you would be able to, that you would just kind of be measuring once every few months? Or are you know, kind of what's the interaction pattern that you're thinking about here?
Yeah. So the holy grail would be a wearable that'll do the metabolites like glucose and also proteins and hormones. And we've talked about this a lot, but I think in our case, what we're building now and what we're really driving to get to market. So our goal is to run a pretty large study towards the end of this year or early next year, where we recruit lots of people that are interested in measuring their markers, mostly for wellness, into the study. And then we can actually show both the efficacy of the device, but also the value of it, so that people are actually able to use the data to improve their lives. So looking at a study of maybe up to 10,000 people with the device over the next year or two, starting with late this year or early next year. And then after that, we'll submit it to the FDA for like general use. That's the current plan. And it's really focusing on what we've been discussing, like all of these types of use cases and building panels around those.
Basically be making it more likely that someone can measure something that's specifically useful for them and on a more continuous or at least a more regular basis.
Yeah, I think the best use case or one of the really great use cases for it, I mean, there are a lot of telemedicine use cases where you make a point measurement and you need to have, like, let's say a doctor's visit that's associated with it. But I think one of the best use cases is really giving more data to companies like Levels, honestly, because it's somebody has to take all this data, interpret it, and give the person like actionable insights, right? So it's really about giving very reliable data that's also really low barrier to entry for people to collect. So if today you have to send a phlebotomist to someone's house to take two tubes of blood and like bring it to a lab or whatever the workflow might be, so just cutting that down to something where they can do it like kind of like as, oh, okay, I think I'll do this today, you know, for 10 minutes before they make their coffee or whatever. So getting that barrier so low that it actually becomes part of like normal life. And this is something that we take blood tests all the time and we have our prototype. So this is something that we're actually experiencing and it's very interesting and fun. And so we're actually pretty excited to, you know, get other people using it outside the company.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, competing with myself and with other people on optimizing blood metrics is one of my goals in life. I think that when we get to that point, I think we've reached a really important milestone for healthcare and for individual health outcomes. When I care enough and there's a competitive element of doing better with something that has such long-term leverage on my health, that's a really good sign. Because today it's really hard to connect the dots between that PDF printout of my, you know, total cholesterol and anything negative in my life. You know, I can walk through life and have no symptom associated with that. But that could be the thing that puts me on my deathbed. So I'm really excited about it. I love what you guys are working on. We've been obviously gone deep on the technical side for a few years now as you guys have worked on it. So excited to be able to make that sort of technology available to, you know, people listening to this podcast and Levels and the general population. Well, this is a great one. I think, you know, there'll be, I expect more to come as you guys continue and as we continue to kind of build in this next gen space. So, yeah, anything else you wanted to touch on before we jump off?
Yeah, I was actually curious, what was the transition like for you going from working at SpaceX and doing engineering on machines, like very complicated machines, right, to dealing with the human body biomarkers and everything related to that? Like, I'm just curious how much has carried over now that it's been a couple of years of like really doing it at scale, actually. What's your experience?
Yeah, I mean,
and what do you miss? It's actually very different. What do you miss about machines?
Oh, a lot. Machines are pretty easy to fully characterize. You know, you can have like a closed form solution for a structure or a mechanism. It can just be like really well understood and designed. And the like analog messiness of the biology is something that I don't even know what I don't know yet, but I know that it's difficult. It's very different. And, you know, a lot of me, I've got this like excitement to start to unlock that black box and learn more about what's going on by attaching, you know, better sensing to our day-to-day lives and like really starting to describe what's going on in the body better. Because it's actually while I was at SpaceX that I got really frustrated by the complete lack of information I had about my health. And then to find out that there really isn't any technology that can make this better. Like, I can't just pay more money to like really describe the hormone patterns in my body. Like, it just basically doesn't exist. So I look forward to us like really leaning in on that and new technologies like what you're working on. But relative to working on machines, it's quite a bit more frustrating, I have to say. Like, there's a lot of hurdles to be able to build a technology and test it. And, you know, if there's anything I miss at SpaceX, first of all, it was an awesome experience and definitely a lot of great people, friends and family that are still there. But the thing that I miss most, I think, is being able to move really, really fast and, you know, as recently as, you know, the Starship example, like, you know, some people look at that as a total failure, and that's actually everyone inside of SpaceX is celebrating that because that's how they build. They just like, you know, once you get to greater than 50-50 chance of success, test it. No further than that, because you're just investing in something even more in something that might fail, and you want to learn quickly why. So I think that's, it's harder to have that sort of mode of operations, especially when you're dealing with, you know, people's real health. And as Theranos found out, like you just can't play with that. You can't be taking huge risks. And so there's something there that is a little bit, you know, I certainly miss being able to work with just like aluminum because there's less risk of that sort of thing. But that said, you know, it's also a really exciting space. And I honestly wish that there was, and I would love to be, you know, I'd love for Levels to kind of eventually be the SpaceX kind of innovator in healthcare. I think that taking a completely different angle, lowering the cost of access and increasing the sort of actionability and usability and scale of this sort of tech, that's what I want to do. So yeah, anyway, I think there's carryover in a philosophical sense in terms of how we're going about things and the scrappy nature. And we're like definitely a small upstart, and especially relative to the healthcare industry. But I think day to day, it's quite a different work experience.
What's like the, if like reusability of, or I guess, I don't know, the original insight at SpaceX was that you could use like off the shelf electronics and things like that, right? I don't know. What was like the original insight that made them successful? And what do you think is the one for Levels? Like, what is like the insight that drives the like ability to get to like the next level where you're like an established player in the industry? Or maybe that's already happened.
I think. But, you know, the insight at SpaceX is like, if you just take a spreadsheet and calculate how much in raw material and sort of manpower it takes to build a rocket, it's orders of magnitude different than how much it would cost you to buy a launch on a rocket.
I see.
At the time that SpaceX was founded. And Elon, looking at that, was like, this is fundamentally a blockade to us being able to increase access to space and like eventually become multiplanetary. Like the fact that the industry has manifested this totally bad solution where you're basically, it wasn't necessarily the off-the-shelf electronics. It's like, not only are you paying orders of magnitude more than it costs, but you are then throwing that thing in single use fashion into the ocean. And so both of those can be solved by just building it for what it costs and then also reusing it like an airplane. For Levels, I think, you know, the insight that I might correlate there is that right now the person receiving value and the person paying for value are totally different in healthcare. Like I ostensibly get value from my healthcare visits. My doctor is the one that delivers it to me, and somebody else, like an insurance provider or some unknown like third party, is responsible for paying for it. And so what I consider to be valuable and what the insurance company considers to be valuable are very different. And what I'm willing to pay and what they're paying and what the value I'm getting are totally disconnected. And so you have this like broken three-party system where what I end up with is a product experience that's not intended to make me happy. It's intended to make the insurance company pay. And I think going back to like the realization that you don't have to force people to participate in healthcare. Like people want to participate in healthcare, but they want to get value from it. And so shifting to like a model where it's a really direct consumerized version of this sort of thing, where people just buy products that are relevant to their quality of life concerns, and they then have to get value from them. Otherwise you don't get a return customer and your business suffers. Like that's what we need in healthcare, in my opinion. Certainly like, you know, I won't say all of healthcare. That's what we need in preventative and sort of health optimization. Then there's like terminal illnesses and there are accidents and the things that healthcare does super well. Like that's a different question. But for me, that's how we'll improve the feedback loop between products that are being produced and a market existing for them. And then I think that opening up access to really unlock traditional supply and demand is the other part that we're doing differently, which is that you know, we aren't going for captive markets where there's like a moat built around it and, you know, like a guaranteed long-term customer. It's actually that, you know, we want to go to the area where the most potential users exist. And that's actually like people who aren't yet sick. Even though rates of illness are really high, like there are still more people who aren't sick than are. And if you build a product that is like exceptional to use and you get like viral distribution because people are like, this is the best thing ever, they tell all their friends about it, you know, you'll unlock like your healthcare product will be, you know, less like a thermometer and more like an Apple Watch. And that's what you want. You know, it's the vitamins versus pills thing. Like people don't, they don't take vitamins, they take pills because it solves a problem for them. And that's why pills are so valuable. And vitamins are, there's like millions of supplement providers. You want to build the pill because it provides value for people and they share that and they like rave about it. So anyway, those are my rambles. Like, you know, TBD on whether or not it's the same degree of unlock that like SpaceX has in aerospace, but for sure there are orders of magnitude in the healthcare system that are not being seen on the value side.
It's very similar in that sense, for sure. In terms of like the lack of effort to cut, like the semiconductor industry is the exact opposite of healthcare or like what the rocket industry looked like in 2000, right? Mm-hmm. It's like every year and a half, you know, even though what's interesting is in the semiconductor industry, you would think it's like software type, like the Silicon Valley type people, but it's not. Like the semiconductor people are pretty, I don't know, this like might be an old timey expression, but they're kind of hard boiled. Like they're not all like techno optimists or like pretending to work 24 hours a day or anything. Like they're just they're just forced to go fast because of competition. I think they would go as slow as the healthcare industry if there was one semiconductor company. You know, like there was one rocket company, right? And it just if there was one semiconductor company, they would maybe still be putting out like, you know, 100 nanometer transistors, right? Why not? You know, it's very hard to make transistors smaller. It takes like enormous gambles. You know, they have to gamble, like companies that are 50 years old have to gamble half the company value to get to the next node or whatever. And why would they ever do that, right? So it's like that element of competition that forces these people. They're not at all the type of people that you encounter in startups or anything like that. They're actually the same, I would say. And that shows that it's not like good people or bad people. It's really the dynamics of the market that make people like, it actually brings out the best. It brings out the best in you, like competition and this steady march of progress that they've had. That's, you know, like if there was a Moore's law of healthcare, I mean, who knows what would be happening at this point, right? So it's like.
Totally. And I think it's a great point. And I think it's like, if you, it's very similar to the aerospace industry where the semiconductor example, you know, if there was like the national semiconductor company, that's exactly what you would see. That's what you saw with aerospace. You had like, you know, there were a few countries that could put something in orbit and none of them had innovated past Apollo with the exception of the shuttle, which we put in a museum. And it's arguable that that wasn't an innovation in terms of cost. So that's what we have with healthcare. We have this gigantic healthcare system. It's heavily regulated and it doesn't actually, you know, it solves certain things really well, but you know, you do not have competition at the system scale. You have competition. You have like a couple blessed providers that work inside Medicare for the same thing, but there's a lot of price fixing, unfortunately, like because of the way the thing works. Medicare sets the price and then everybody gets that price.